You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Nikola Tesla was one of a group of great inventors at the beginning of the 20th century whose work would utterly change what we know as life through the next 100 years. But unlike Edison or Marconi, Tesla was far lesser known until recent years. But for some, it's Tesla's work that forms a foundation for our contemporary technology. Even today, the most promising electric car company on the horizon bears his name. But for others, he's known more as a mad scientist by some for his theatrics and his annual press conferences with far-fetched ideas about the future. But despite that, Tesla's inventions, patents, and theoretical work form the basis of modern AC electricity, alternating current, and help contribute to the development of radio and television. My guest today has written a biography of Tesla that focuses less on the eccentricities of the man, but on the how and why of his inventiveness and inventions. Tesla, Inventor of the Electrical Age, is published by Princeton University Press. My guest today is W. Bernard Carlson, a professor of science, technology, and society in the School of Engineering and a professor of history at the University of Virginia. He's the author of several books on the technological process, and he writes easily for techies and non-techies alike and gives readers real insight into the scientific creative process. Today we learn more about Nikola Tesla. Bernie Carlson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Rich.
Nikola Tesla's reputation has certainly grown since his death, when most of the press in New York, they still would go to his annual press conferences, but he was considered somewhat of, I guess you could almost call him a mad scientist. I think that was his popular view at that particular time, talking about particle beam weapons in the 1930s and early 1940s. But since his death, he's become relatively known in the scientific community and beyond the scientific community. I mean, you have Tesla Motor Corporation that took their name for their car company. And his name and his contributions are starting to be recognized. Why did we not teach about Tesla in our history books for so long?
When Tesla dies in 1943, you're absolutely right. He dies under a bit of a cloud. He's been living very poorly, very modestly in New York hotels for the last 30 years of his life. He's trying to convince people that he has wonderful new inventions that are going to revolutionize the world, the last one being the idea of a particle beam weapon that would be able to shoot down planes and protect America from bombers coming from Europe or Japan in World War II. And all of that sort of suggests that he was a bit, as you say, a bit of a mad scientist. Add to that the larger cultural context of post-World War II America and the development of the Cold War, where technology was seen as being very important, but things like the atomic bomb or radar or the polio vaccine were all going to come from hard science, that they were going to be the result of research in laboratories done by PhD experts. And there really wasn't any place for a character like Tesla, who studied engineering as a young man but didn't have any university affiliations when he was doing his work in the 1890s and 1900s, and was not really able to be presented as the sort of modern man of science that was delivering up technology. He had also cultivated an image of being a master showman, a bit of a magician, and always emphasized that his ideas came from his imagination and from intuition. And all of those things worked against him with, as I say in the book at one point, the apostles of modernity. In other words, people that were promoting this very rational, highly scientific view. And he just simply wasn't useful for presenting science and engineering in the ways that people in the Cold War in America wanted to present science.
He was kind of, in many ways, the last of the solo inventors, you know, the man who has a eureka or has the idea and works it out by himself, as opposed to working with a team and a collaboration and, a laboratory, so to speak.
That's right. He's one of the very last of the heroic inventors of the same class as Thomas Edison or Alexander Graham Bell or the Wright brothers, and he has sort of an extra whammy working against him in that no company is built up around his patents. In the same way that there are Edison companies even today, there are still Edison power companies in and around the United States, or you have in Europe the major cell phone company is still Marconi Cable and Wireless. Mm-hmm. And so they keep the individual heroic inventor in the public imagination, whereas Tesla, until the development of the Tesla Motor Company, basically had no kind of corporate presence. His name had just been forgotten in the business world.
And, of course, Tesla was just the name they chose. It's not necessarily sinister. It comes out of Tesla's own, well, I guess it does come out of his work through the batteries, but it's not his company.
No, it's not his company. And they, Elon Musk and the other Silicon Valley entrepreneurs behind it, were able to utilize Tesla because Tesla basically had no family and had no one basically looking after his intellectual, if you will, his brand name, his intellectual property, and so it was in the public domain and they could just appropriate it. But I think that it was a smart move on their part because Tesla, on one hand, represents high technology. In other words, he was in his time at the cutting edge of electricity and working on alternating current motors and wireless power. So they capture that high-tech quality with calling the company Tesla Motors. At the same time, Tesla basically is a countercultural character. He marches to a beat of a different drummer. He's something of an underdog, challenging the establishment of Thomas Edison and J.P. Morgan with his visions of new ways of doing things with electricity. And so they get a little bit of that cutting edge. They get the cutting edge high-tech, but they also get a bit of a countercultural spin to their products.
Now, one of the things you wrote that you wanted to do in this book was not necessarily focus on Tesla's life, his eccentricities, as much as why and how he invented. And certainly the book does take us through the process of inventing. At times he would describe alternating current as a eureka moment, but what you point out that this was something he spent years refining.
That's right. When you write about inventors, which is what I've done for most of my career last 20 years, the immediate fork in the road that you come to is invention about personality and genius and luck, or is it about the fact that these highly creative individuals actually have a method, a strategy, a style? In other words, that there are ways of describing and understanding what they're doing. And I went down the second path. I'm a big believer that there are extremely talented people and that we can unpack, we can explore how they actually do things. And that's what I hope I accomplish in this book is rather than just sort of saying, oh, well, he was a genius or he got incredibly lucky, to say, well, he was somebody who actually had a way of working through problems. And I'm teaching an engineering school. I'm not an engineer, I'm a historian, but I'm dedicated to training the next generation of creative designers and innovators. And I think there are important lessons that Tesla offers for them.
Now, he was born in what was at that point a pretty much a backwater of the Austrian Empire, what's now Croatia. It seems to me very surprising from that background, I guess his ministers in the family and the like, that he would become an engineer in the first place.
Yes, it's a very surprising origin, his childhood life. One of the great contrasts, I think, that after I finished the book I began to think about was when he's born in 1856, he's born in the mountains of what is today Croatia, which was, and at that time, was the military frontier of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. In other words, the border state between the Austrian Empire and the Ottoman Turkish Empire. And the border continually moved back and forth, but to protect themselves from an invasion by the Turks, the Austrians essentially intermingled and encouraged Serbs to settle in this mountainous region. And while he was there, his family basically was as much of the middle class as you were going to find at that time, in that if you weren't going to be a peasant, there were really two paths upwards. One is you joined the Austrian army, or you went on into and became a minister in the Serbian Orthodox Church, which is like the Greek or the Russian Orthodox Church. And in fact, the Russians and the Serbs have a very deep relationship as a result of sharing the same set of religious beliefs. And Tesla, as a young man, was earmarked. His father was a priest, his uncles were priests, and they were sure that he should be going into the ministry as well. And just as he finished high school, he got terribly sick with a cholera epidemic that came through his town. And on his near deathbed, his father said, anything you want, if you just would get better. And he said, well, to tell you the truth, I really don't want to go to the seminary. I want to go to engineering school. And his father said, done, we'll do it. And as a result, it took a year. He had to sort out his draft requirements with the Austrians, but his father and his uncles got him into one of the engineering schools that existed at that time in the Austrian Empire.
Obviously very talented, and within a few years, he's starting to work for Edison in Europe.
That's right. And what happens is he has a classic slacker period, and he drops out of engineering school. He becomes the master at playing billiards and supports himself doing a combination of engineering work and shooting pool. And and eventually, his a couple of his uncles sort of, his father passes on, a couple of his uncles take him under their wing, and they say, enough of this, and they get him a job, as you say, working for one of the Edison companies that's developing in the, this is now, we're talking the late 1870s, Rich, in Budapest, where they want to install one of the first telephone switchboards. So he goes to Budapest to help out with that, and he does a good job with that. And he then is transferred to the Paris offices of the Edison company. He learns electric lighting and electric generators, how to design electric generators there. And from there, he's transferred to New York, and he arrives in 1884 with a letter in his pocket from one of the managers and investors in the Edison companies in Europe. And the letter basically says, "Dear Mr. Edison, there are two great men in the world. You are one, and this young man is the other."
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't that a great letter of recommendation? And, I know students that would love to have one like that.
Well, and as you write in the book, you know, at the same time he's learning more about the Edison systems and the electric lighting and the system for arc lighting, you know, he's basically saying there's a better way. You seem to think that he's starting to experiment with maybe there's a better way of doing this.
That's right. One of the probably really early signs that he's going to have an exceptional life or interesting career is, in about his sophomore year in engineering school, his favorite professor demonstrates an electric motor in the classroom, which was really cutting edge. And it didn't work that well. It sparked a great deal. And Tesla said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to get rid of the sparking problem, and we're going to do so by eliminating the rotating switch that was on the motor, which is called a commutator. And his professor said, ha! You're never going to do this. No way. And there was a whole physics explanation that said that getting rid of that switch would have been the equivalent of creating a perpetual motion machine. Now, most kids would have sort of slunk out of the room and said, oh, you know, he's right. I'm never going to amount to anything. Tesla basically thought about it. He said, no, I'm going to solve this problem. And he devoted the next 7 to 10 years of his life thinking about this. And along the way, what happens is he decides that in exploring and solving this problem, what he really wants to do to make a better motor, a sparkless motor, is to use alternating current. And as a result, he comes up with the first practical alternating current motor, which means that for the first time in the late 1880s, electric power companies, utilities, can shift from being just simply electric light companies. They all start, many of them started out as Edison Electric Light Company of New York, or I don't know that there was one in Tulsa or not, or Edison Electric Light of Chicago. And Westinghouse takes advantage of Tesla's invention of the motor, and he says, we can now have electric light and power companies. And power could be delivered using this motor, taking advantage of alternating current.
And it's safely. That's the big
thing. Safely was a major issue, and Tesla helped figure out ways to come up with the very practical engineering solutions that you need in terms of how you design the circuits, how you mount the wires either underground or on power poles, and the insulation and all the whole nine yards.
Now, it seems like if he developed the whole nine yards, I mean, this is such a major breakthrough. Why is he not more famous for this? You know, from that point on, he pretty much does a lot of the theoretical work for all of what would become our power system.
Well, he provides the underlying idea or vision. And as I often say, along with the alternating current motor, the other way that you encounter Tesla day in, day out is the power that is delivered to most homes and businesses comes in as either two or three phase power. And I'm not going to try to explain to you what we mean by two or three phase power. However, two- or three-phase power does have simply the advantage that you can deliver more power at certain voltages, and that means that the whole system runs much more efficiently. That's the critical thing that you and our listeners need to know about. But the critical thing is before that, all alternating current was single-phase. People were working at the Edison systems that were DC, direct current, or they were using single-phase AC systems. We now use around the world probably almost all the power is transmitted and distributed using two- or three-phase, multi-phase. And that's Tesla provided that big idea. The reason why he's not well-known in some ways is, again, think about, we just sort of automatically say the phrase R&D, or research and development. And we often focus on that creative eureka moment of coming up with a light bulb or the first computer chip or the Wright brothers fly in 1903. And that's the R part. That's the research part. That's that creative invention. We don't pay a whole lot of interest in our culture to the really interesting and important work that is the development side, which is solving all the problems, getting from having a great idea to having something that people use every day. And it's beginning to change. I think that, for example, there are a lot of interesting parallels that we could talk, we could talk a little bit about between Tesla and Steve Jobs. But what did Steve Jobs do? He actually orchestrated the development side. In other words, his good friend Wozniak came up with an amazing computer circuit and figured out how to build a personal computer. But if you've ever seen the original Apple I, it was in a wooden box. And it was completely cobbled together. And from the get-go, Jobs said, we need to make this, put this in a well-designed case. We need to make some decisions about the things that people can mess and adjust with. We need to simplify this thing so it can be a computer for everyone. And that process by which you figure out how to make something that works well for large numbers of people is not something that up to now we've really paid a whole lot of attention to. And I think that one of the interesting things that we're talking about as a result of Jobs or Tesla or anyone else is, what is all this creative stuff that has to happen so that things don't just appear magically in our lives as new technologies, but what's the creative endeavor that people have to do? And Tesla he's part of the whole story of alternating current is all of that stuff has to happen. And he provides the vision, the starting point, the Westinghouse engineers do a lot of the heavy lifting. But I think he gets left out because we sort of want to collapse electricity down into, got an electric light, we're all set, you know, next stop, you know, we're going to be completely wired up country.
That's right.
And it's decades of work, and Tesla's part of those decades of work.
My guest today is W. Bernard Carlson, a professor of science, technology, and society, as well as history at the University of Virginia. And he is the author of Tesla, Inventor of the Electrical Age. It's published by Princeton University Press. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Now, in Tesla's case, he was doing electrical demonstrations where he was basically running thousands of volts through his body to show how safe electricity could be. Is this true?
This is absolutely true. He understood that the way to sort of fund his research was to get really strong patents and then get people really excited about the inventions and then sell the rights to the patents. So he understood that a big part of his job as an inventor was not just to do the laboratory work, to tinker around in the workroom, but to get out there and get people excited about the new technology. Again, the parallel between, you know, there's a little bit of a parallel here between Jobs, who is working with his designers, working with his computer programmers. But what's one of the things that we really remember about Jobs? Jobs has these incredible product launches, which were, over the years, major news events. Is whenever he would launch a new computer or the iPod or the iPad, they were huge. And Tesla did the same thing. Now, Tesla, unlike Jobs, was willing to basically walk up to a giant high-frequency, high-voltage transformer, what we would now call a Tesla coil, and put his hand on one terminal and hold up a light bulb in the other, and the light bulb, the electricity would flow through him and make the bulb glow. And there are descriptions of him when he was doing this that he would have a halo around his entire body. In other words,
wow.
he'd be glowing. I mean, as I always tell kids, don't try this one at home, because he's taken 250,000 volts. Now, the way he can do this is what's called the skin effect, which is electricity, based on the physics of it, always wants to be on the outer surface of the body or the conductor that it's flowing through. In other words, it doesn't want to go through the middle of the body or the middle of the wire. It wants to be on the surface. And so if you get the conditions just right, the electricity doesn't go through your heart. It basically travels across your skin, makes the skin glow, but you can survive a 250,000-volt shock. It meant that at times he was seen as a real magician.
Yeah, no doubt. But after he sold his patents to Westinghouse, he had a bundle of cash. He's off to something else, and this was wireless technology and wireless things that would help develop radio and television. But unlike with electricity, he was sort of on, if not the wrong track, just not nearly as successful with these ventures. In fact, a lot of them were failures.
Well, they do turn out to be failures, but let's again, as a historian, I love to put things into their time frame, into their context. So you're a big success. It's 1889, and he's got money burning a hole in his pocket, and he wants to be experimenting, he wants to do new things. And so he finds out that there are European scientists who have first theorized that there are radio waves, and then second, have actually detected them. And Tesla is the first person to sort of say, I see what Heinrich Hertz, and that's why we always say things have, radio stations have so many megacycles or megahertz. Right. It's named after that famous scientist. So Tesla says, I see what Hertz, the scientist, is doing. I'm going to make some technology around this. Now, what's the big success at that particular moment? You know, we're standing around, it's 1890. For Tesla, it's all about power. It is about following Edison's lead, Edison and Westinghouse's, their leads, and coming up with a new power system. In other words, there's an earlier arc lighting system, that's 1G, first generation. Edison's system is DC incandescent lighting system is the second generation, 2G. Westinghouse AC is 3G. And so Tesla's like saying, I'm going to bring you 4G. I'm going to bring you the next generation of electrical power technology. And so he decides that the way to do it is to take advantage of radio waves. Now, as it turns out, that's a tough sell because you've got to make the thing work, and you've got to basically displace all of these previously installed and developed companies. So you've taken on the world. Marconi, his major rival in this area, is a younger guy and has better business advisors. And I think between Marconi's strategic sense and his business advisors, they say, Marconi, let's not take on the world. Let's take on a much simpler job, which is sending messages.
Yeah, communicating rather than sending power. Yeah,
exactly. And let's find a market. This is Marconi's genius. Marconi's company basically says, we are going to go into a market where there are no competitors, which is ship-to-shore communications. We are not going to compete with the telephone or the telegraph. We're going to go where you can't send an electric message. And as a result, they were able to get start up in that niche market and move into more into other areas. So Tesla dreams big, gambles big, and isn't successful. But he's as far as people standing around watching the development of the radio industry circa 1900, basically people are sort of saying, it's going to be Tesla. I don't know who this Marconi guy is. It's going to be Tesla. And in fact, even in the newspaper stories in December of 1901, when Marconi sort of says, well, I've heard this little hazy signal that has been sent from England to St. John's, Newfoundland, the papers basically turn to Tesla and say, so do you think he did it? And Tesla says, well, maybe he did it, maybe he didn't do it, but I'm right here. You know, I'm the other radio guy. And the Navy, the U.S. Navy courted and continued to court Tesla until probably 1903 or 1904 because they preferred a homegrown inventor based in America as opposed to having to do a deal with Marconi. And Marconi had already begun to do deals with the British Navy. But Tesla all the way through until he really has this nervous breakdown about 1905 is seen as clearly the rival, very highly likely rival or the inventor of radio.
After his unsuccessful experiments, he had all these huge ground towers that were coming out. At some point, he's sort of delving in theoretical works, and he's doing press conferences on his birthday and announcing all of these particular ideas. In fact, when he dies, the FBI comes in and, somebody seizes his papers right afterwards because of the war going on, because they were afraid he might actually have a particle beam. But when you look at those later theoretical works, was there good science in those theoretical works?
Sadly, there wasn't. His method of invention focused on what we would call in sort of the philosophy of science or in certain areas, in psychology, he had what we'd call a confirmatory bias. In other words, all he needed to do was to see a little bit of evidence that supported what he had imagined in his mind, the invention that he had been able to visualize in his very powerful memory and visual thinking skills could be realized, could happen. And he only needed a little bit of tiny evidence for those sorts of things. And he didn't go the path that the way we train engineers and scientists today, and the way that a fellow like Edison learned the hard way is you always torture, if you're an inventor, you always torture test your device. You basically run it at full speed, or you up the voltage, or whatever you have to do, until the thing falls apart. Because when it falls apart, you then go in and you say, why did it fall apart? Do I need a stronger piece there, or do I need to change the circuit there? And there's a wonderful story that I use to contrast Tesla and Edison in the book, which is when Edison is working on the phonograph in the 1877-1878, he basically builds the phonograph, designs the phonograph, gives the drawings to his machinists, his sketches, and says, build one of these things. And the machinist builds the thing, brings it in. Edison shouts Mary Had a Little Lamb into the thing, changes from the record to the playback mode, and lo and behold, the phonograph plays the song back. As Edison says, I was never so shocked in my life. Because he always depended on the machine failing, that is to say, disconfirming itself, so then you could figure out how to make it better. Now, Tesla just kind of worked in an entirely different way. As long as he kept getting a little bit of positive signals that this thing was more or less on the right track, that what he imagined could happen out there in the world, out there in the physical world, he kept going. And so as a result, even in later life, he would imagine these things, be able to do a little bit of mathematics, a little bit of sort of thought experiments, and say, of course it'll work. Of course I can make a particle beam weapon. But he would never reduce it to practice and deal with the, as a good former engineering professor and a good friend of mine used to say here in the civil engineering classes, he would teach a class on concrete, and he would at one point show the students how the equations didn't work, and he'd then turn and he'd say, he was a Scotsman, you say, there you see the diabolical nature of concrete. That is to say that the material world messes with your best laid schemes, your best ideas. And Tesla just, sadly at the end of his life, never let facts get in the way of a great theory. And it's sad, but that was his, on one hand it was his strength, because when he was working on the alternating current stuff, he had a vision, he had an ideal. And man, he wanted to see that happen. And again, you know, Jobs always said, keep it simple. We want amazing technology, but Steve Jobs always emphasized, we're going to focus these designs on the best possible way of what Jobs thought was the way of doing it. But they both had that sort of single-minded, idealist approach. While on one hand it gets you amazing technology, sometimes it also can get in the way of doing other things. And so at the end of his life, Tesla is sadly spinning out great ideas, visions of grandeur, but they're not feasible.
Yeah. Well, the name of the book is Tesla, Inventor of the Electrical Age. Bernie Carlson, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you, and I hope your listeners have learned a little bit more about Tesla and the world of invention.
W. Bernard Carlson is the author of Tesla, Inventor of the Electrical Age. It's published by Princeton University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.